This is the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac, Isaac the father of Jacob, Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers, Judah the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar, Perez the father of Hezron, Hezron the father of Ram, Ram the father of Amminadab, Amminadab the father of Nashon, Nashon the father of Salmon, Salmon the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab, Boaz the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth, Obed the father of Jesse, and Jesse the father of King David. David was the father of Solomon, whose mother had been Uriah's wife, Solomon the father of Rehoboam, Rehoboam the father of Abijah, Abijah the father of Asa, Asa the father of Jehoshaphat, Jehoshaphat the father of Jehoram, Jehoram the father of Uzziah, Uzziah the father of Jotham, Jotham the father of Ahaz, Ahaz the father of Hezekiah, Hezekiah the father of Manasseh, Manasseh the father of Amon, Amon the father of Josiah, and Josiah the father of Jeconiah and his brothers at the time of the exile of Babylon. After the exile to Babylon, Jeconiah, the father of Shealtiel, Shealtiel, the father of Zerubbabel, Zerubbabel, the father of Abihud, Abihud, the father of Eliakim, Eliakim, the father of Azor, Azor, the father of Zadok, Zadok, the father of Akim, Akim, the father of Elihud, Elihud, the father of Eleazar, Eleazar, the father of Mathan, Mathan, the father of Jacob, and Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, and Mary was the mother of Jesus, who was called the Messiah. Thus there were 14 generations in all from Abraham to David, 14 from David to the exile to Babylon, and 14 from the exile to the Messiah.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. Absolutely excellent, excellent reading. And by the way, if you were here last week, please do not adjust your set. Yes, this is the same passage. Yes, this is the same unlikely passage. But there is something about the Bible that there's always more gospel to discover on the pages of the Bible. And I think
in the most obscure corners, you find the brightest lights. And there's just some beauty in here. And actually, if you were here last week, we only looked at two people. We only looked at Abraham and David, and there are 46 more names to enjoy. So I hope you're in for a long morning. But actually, as we come to this, here's a question first. Why is this list here? Why does a Christmas story start like this? And one answer is that this family tree is something like a CV. Don't know if you've applied for a job recently, you've written your CV, and your CV lists your education, it has all your achievements, it has all the things that you've done well, it's just your personal statement, which is a great work of fiction, isn't it? I know Rachel Reeves has been in the media recently for maybe inflating her CV about her economic credentials, but even the best CVs are all about what you've done. If you've written your CV, it says, this is who I am. This is what I'm great at. These are my achievements, my successes, my qualifications. But in Jesus' day, nobody would have cared. Nobody would have cared what you've done. Who cares how great you think you are? Because in Jesus' day, what mattered was not you. What mattered was not what you've done. It wasn't about you. It was about your family. It wasn't an individualistic culture, it was a community culture. And so in Jesus' day, what mattered was not you and your track record, what mattered was your family and who you've come from. And that's why Matthew starts this story of Jesus' life with a CV, if you like, but it's not like a CV that we would write. It's a family tree. Because what matters most is not what you've done, but who you've come from. And if you were here last week, sorry, can we have the PowerPoint slide up? That'll be great. Thanks. If you were here last week, what we were looking at was Jesus' family tree. And what we were saying last week was that family trees were selective. They weren't exhaustive. And we were saying last week that father of could mean grandfather of or great-grandfather of. So you never listed every name in your family tree. You were selective. And you were very careful about who you picked out to name check in your family tree. You were selective. So just like when you write your CV, you're selective. You don't list the exams you failed. You don't list the mistakes you make. And you definitely choose very carefully who's going to write the reference for you. CVs were selective. Well, family trees were selective. And so people like King Herod, the same King Herod from the Christmas story, he was a very insecure king because he actually wasn't qualified to be king. He wasn't really very Jewish, if at all, and he wasn't descended from David. And so Herod doctored his family tree like a dodgy CV. Herod even tried to burn down the public records building so that no one could research his family tree and find out that he wasn't kosher. And Matthew's family tree, unlike Herod's, Matthew's family tree is true, but Matthew's family tree of Jesus is selective, and that's no surprise there. That's no surprise. That's how family trees work. The surprise is who Matthew chooses to put into his family tree. Because Matthew doesn't just pick great old father Abraham we looked at last week or great King David we looked at last week. He doesn't just varnish the family tree to make it look good. Matthew has chosen to include a prostitute, a murderer, a case of incest, some hated enemies, outsiders, idolaters, weak men, and abused women. And the surprise is he really didn't have to, but he chose to put them in. Because what Matthew is saying is look who Jesus came from. Jesus doesn't have a polished family tree. Look at who Jesus came from, and look at who Jesus comes for. That's what the whole book of Matthew will be about. Look at who Jesus spent his time with. He came for people just like this. This is who he came from, and this is who he comes for. And he comes from people with a murky past. He comes for people with a murky past. And he comes for you. And as I said, in this story, there are 48 names here, and we're going to look at all of them. I'm just kidding. You do, I'm sure, have homes to go to. But I'm just going to look at a handful of names. And I look at them under two headings, and the first is the mothers of Jesus, and then we'll look at the fathers of Jesus. The mothers of Jesus, and the first surprise here for me is that Matthew includes any of the mothers of Jesus. Because women were never mentioned in family trees 2,000 years ago. And of course, in so many countries or for so many centuries, women would have been almost invisible. And even in Jesus' day, women had almost no rights. They couldn't own property. They couldn't inherit property, sorry. They couldn't give testimony in court. They were somewhat owned by their fathers and then by their husbands. And the first surprise is that Matthew mentions five of the mothers of Jesus. And the first in verse 3 is Tamar. So we read in verse 3, Judah, the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar. Even before we come to Tamar, what is odd? What is odd about that verse? What is odd about mentioning both Perez and Zerah? They're twins, but of course in a family tree, only one of them can be the parent of the next generation. Why mention both? It's odd that both names are mentioned, because obviously only one can be a great-grandfather, and that's Perez. So why mention Zerah? Well, I think Matthew probably includes both of those names because he wants us to remember the story of how they were born. And it's a pretty sordid story of prostitution and incest. Because these twins' father, Judah, was both their father and their father-in-law at the same time. They must have messed with their heads. And here's the story. Tamar marries Judah's eldest son, but God puts him to death because of wickedness. And then Tamar marries Judah's second oldest son, but God puts him to death because of wickedness. And Judah's a bit afraid at this point. So Judah says to Tamar, he says, stay in my house, stay in my home. I'll care for you. I'll look after you. I'll provide for you. But he doesn't. And Tamar gets so fed up that she disguises herself as a prostitute. And Judah, her father-in-law, goes looking for a prostitute. And he sleeps with her. and she becomes pregnant. And so verse 3, Judah was the father of Perez because of incest, something that God forbids. And yet Tamar is included in Jesus' family tree. And then you jump down a couple of verses to verse 5, and you read Salmon, the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab. So who was Rahab? Well, Rahab grew up in the time of the Exodus, and she was a Canaanite, a bitter enemy. So that's one strike against her. And God had said that the wickedness of the Canaanites was so bad, it stank, it rose up to high heaven, and they were going to be judged, and they were going to be wiped out. And that's another strike against her. And Rahab grew up in Jericho, which was a kind of fortress city on the very borders of the Promised Land. It was meant to guard, to keep people out. That's another strike. And then as the people of the Exodus are going into the Promised Land, they send in spies, and two spies go into the city of Jericho. And as they're being chased by the city police, Rahab protects them. But then you discover that Rahab isn't running an Airbnb. She's also a prostitute. That's another strike against her. But because Rahab risks her life to protect the spies, so God protects her and her family. But Rahab is a Canaanite, an enemy, a prostitute. But she's included in Jesus' family tree. And you think this is pretty dark. And so you get to verse 5 and you go, Boaz, the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth. She's lovely. There's nothing bad about Ruth. There's no dirt on her. She's one of the most lovely people in the Old Testament. She's a kind of a rare glint of beauty in the darkness of the murk. And she is. But her family tree wasn't. Half a dozen times in her book, she's always called Ruth the Moabitess. Not just Ruth. Ruth the Moabitess, as if to say, look who she comes from. Ruth's family are enemies. Moab. And this is not just any enemy. This is the Marks and Spencers of enemies. Because Moab was so nasty and devious and sneaky. They seduced God's people with sex and idolatry. And God had said, Moabites are so wicked that no Moabite will be allowed near me, near my temple, near my presence, even down to the 10th generation. But here we have Ruth, the Moabitess, a first generation Moabite. And she's included in Jesus' family tree. So look at the mothers of Jesus. You've got Tamar, you've got Rahab, you've got Ruth, you've got incest, you've got prostitution, you've got outcasts, you've got enemies. And then in verse 6, there's a woman, a mother who's not even named in verse 6. Jesse, the father of King David. David was the father of Solomon, whose mother had been Uriah's wife. Why did Matthew write it like that? Why doesn't he mention Bathsheba by name? Why say she had been Uriah's wife? What is Matthew saying? I think what Matthew was saying is, remember David? Remember the great king? Remember this guy that we talked about last week? The guy we all look up to? Yeah, he's the guy who slept with another man's wife. And the story here is that David saw Bathsheba and his lust led him to sleep with her and then to murder Uriah to cover it up. And one of their children was Solomon. Lust, adultery, lies, murder, cover up. And yet Bathsheba, the wife of Uriah, is mentioned in Jesus' family tree. And there's one more mother of Jesus, and you'll see her in verse 16. And that's Mary. And who's Mary? She's a nobody. Mary is from a small backwater town. She's a young teenager. She's just not important. Mary and Joseph are dirt poor peasants. Do you remember when Jesus is taken to the temple when he's a month old and they should have brought a sacrifice of a lamb, but they couldn't even afford the sacrifice of a lamb. They could only afford two pigeons. And you think, pigeons, those are the things that flock around the town square and are dirty and they're two a penny. That's all they could afford. Mary is a nobody. She's insignificant. And the outrage, of course, is that she becomes pregnant before she's married. And even all through Jesus' life, there'll be a stink of that parentage about about the story there. And yet Mary is included in Jesus' family tree. Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, Bathsheba, Mary, the mothers of Jesus. And again, as I was saying, remember that family trees are selective. Matthew didn't have to choose these names, but he chose these names. He didn't have to include any women. Most family trees never included any women. But he includes these women and their stories of incest and prostitution and sexual sin and idol worship. Yeah, the mothers of Jesus are sinners and outcasts and nobodies. And so you think, well, maybe the fathers of Jesus, they must be better. There must be something better here. There must be some heroes here. But you know, they're even more screwed up. They stink even more. So take Judah just as an example. Yeah, Judah from the tribe of Judah. That Judah. Yes, Tamar dressed up as a prostitute and tricked him. But what the heck was Judah doing looking for a prostitute in the first place? And the whole sad story of Judah and Tamar happens because, well, Judah won't do what he says he will do. Judah doesn't care for Tamar. He doesn't look after the vulnerable. By the way, all through the Bible, a sign of true manliness is of someone who looks after the vulnerable. Judah doesn't provide for Tamar as he should have done as her father-in-law. And a few months later, when it becomes obvious that Tamar is pregnant, well, Judah bristles, he puffs out his chest, and full of self-righteousness, he says, "Bring out Tamar, she shall be put to death." And as she's being led out to be burned, at the last minute, Tamar says, "The man who slept with me never paid me, but he gave me his walking stick and his ring." Anyone recognize this staff and this signet ring? I'm not saying that what Tamar did was right, but I am saying that what Judah did was very, very wrong. He was in a position of power and he should have protected the weak and he didn't. And he was a hypocrite and a liar and a fraud. But this is the tribe that Jesus comes from. Judah is in Jesus' family tree. Now, maybe we shouldn't blame Judah because, well, he had a pretty bad role model in his dad. All of us, maybe it's just me, we blame our parents, don't we, for all our character flaws. And Judah could have done that because who was his dad? It was Jacob. You know what the name Jacob means? Yeah, exactly. He cheats. So can you imagine tea time? Hey, cheater, come and get your tea. That's not the kind of guy you want to play Monopoly with at Christmas, is it? He's called Cheater, and he lives up to his name. He cheats his brother Esau. He tricks his blind father. And basically, Jacob schemes and cheats and lies his way all through life. But Jacob is included in Jesus' family tree. And you think, well, I hope there are some good guys. There must be some good guys. The next good guy must be David. David's a good guy. He's a man after God's own heart. He's the man that God made such promises to. But this is the same David who saw Bathsheba and wanted her. And because he was an all-powerful king, he could get what he wanted, and he did. And actually, that was an appalling abuse of power. He was the perpetrator, and she was the victim. It's all very 2024. And I think Matthew wants us to see that or to remember that, because I think that's why he doesn't call her Bathsheba. I think that's why he calls her, she had been Uriah's wife. I don't think that's a slight on Bathsheba. I think that's a slight on David, because it sets up such a contrast. By naming Uriah, he wouldn't normally get mentioned in a family tree. By naming Uriah, you set up this contrast between David and this one decent guy in the whole list, Uriah. Imagine this was a film. Imagine a flashback to the black and white days. And you're flashing back to the days when David was on the run from bad King Saul. Like Robin Hood, he was hiding. And around him, he had a band of brothers, of best friends. And Uriah was one of his best friends. Uriah was one of his mighty men. Uriah had been with David. He'd been loyal to David. He'd protected David in his most difficult days. He always got this nickname, Uriah the Hittite, as if to remind everybody that he was an outsider. But he was always with David. And do you remember when David first sets his eyes on Bathsheba, where is Uriah at that point? What is Uriah doing at that point? He's still fighting David's battles for him. And when David gets Uriah home and gets him drunk so that he can cover up his sin, Uriah is more honourable than David. And as I said, he's always Uriah the Hittite, a bit like Ruth the Moabite. He's always identified by being an outsider, by being a former enemy. And yet this outsider is more godly than God's own king. And in the end, instead of confessing his sin, David murders Uriah. And this is David. This is the man after God's own heart who he made promises to, who abuses power and takes advantage. He takes what isn't his. He commits adultery. He lies. He murders and tries to get away with it. But David is included in Jesus' family tree. And what about Solomon, David's son? Now, surely there's no dirt on him. He was such a wise man, the wisest man who lived. And life under his reign was brilliant. The streets were almost paved with gold. But he was a wise king in some ways, but he was an absolute fool at heart. And Solomon's hundreds and hundreds of wives lead him astray. He loves many women, was the epitaph, but they led his heart astray to worship their gods. And he leads the country, the whole nations astray to worship their gods. Even Molech, the worst god, the detestable god that demanded child sacrifice. But Solomon is included in Jesus' family tree. And even if you just scan down the list of kings, you come across guys like Rehoboam, the Egypt, the guy who caused civil war and split the country. You've got kings like Asa, who started out so well, but once he becomes powerful, he becomes proud, and the Lord judges him with leprosy, and he's exiled. He lives, or he dies, a sad and lonely death. And Manasseh, who is such a bad and godless king that God says it's because of Manasseh that that the exile to Babylon will happen. It's because of Manasseh there'll be no second chances, there'll be no more delay. And you've got Jeconiah, also known as Jehoiakim, who is cursed by Jeremiah. Record this man as childless. None of his children will sit on the throne of David. That is to say, look at the mothers of Jesus, but look at the fathers of Jesus. And every king here turns out to have feet of clay. And yet they're included in Jesus' family tree. Because Jesus comes from a family of real people, of messed up people, because this is history and it is his story. Or to put it another way, the Christmas story is not a fairy story. The New Testament doesn't start once upon a time. Doesn't even start a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. Because Jesus' story is not a fairy story. Although, surprisingly, as you read on, you find out that Jesus is the prince. And he will slay the dragon. And he will win his bride. And he will live happily ever after. But Jesus' coming does not start once upon a time, because Jesus and the Christmas story is not a fireside story for children. It is history. It is rooted in history. And the roots, they are not pretty. But I think what Matthew is saying is Jesus came from people like that, because you'll see in the next 28 chapters, he came for people like that. And you find that Jesus came for men and women. And in fact, we read a lot that Jesus spent a lot of time with women. And when Jesus rose from the dead, who were the first witnesses to his resurrection? They were women who legally couldn't be trusted in those days, who legally couldn't give testimony to such an amazing event. But Jesus came for women and for men, equally, equally loved, equally precious, equally valuable, equally honored, equally saved by Jesus through the cross. Jesus comes for men and women, and he comes for Jews and Gentiles, insiders and outsiders. So Tamar and Rahab and Ruth, they are all Gentiles. Even great-grandfather Abraham, he was a moon worshipper in Iraq before God called him and gave him many promises. But Jesus came for Jews and Gentiles. In the very last words of Matthew's story, of his biography, the last words are to his friends, it's go, Go to all nations, to the ends of the earth, and tell them about who I am. Yes, go even as far as Kendal. Because Jesus came for men and women. He came for Jew and Gentile. And he came for rich and poor. Yeah, he came for gold-plated Solomon. He came for dirt-poor Mary. And in the Gospels, you see him mixing with the ruling classes and with peasants and beggars, because Jesus came for rich and poor. And he came for the known and the unknown. Most of the names at the end of this list are, they're a mystery to me. The 400 years or so from Zerubbabel onwards, that we know almost nothing about anybody. It's almost as if there's nothing interesting to say about them, but Jesus came for them too. And he came for the good and the bad. He came for good guys like Boaz and Uriah. And he came for bad guys like Judah. And he came for the moral and the immoral. Because in the Gospels, you see Jesus mixing with moral Pharisees and immoral sinners and tax collectors. That is, Jesus came for those who think they're good, and he came for those who know they're bad. And he came for great and small. He came for kings as well as peasants. And he came for heroes and villains, for perpetrators and victims, for prostitutes and kings. And if you thought your family tree was messed up, just look at Jesus' family tree. But Jesus comes from them and he comes for them. And how do you come into Jesus' family? How do you come into God's family? Only through Jesus. You see, do you enter God's family because you've been a good boy or a good girl? Or you've never messed up or you always color inside the lines? No, never. We've just seen that's not true. How do you enter God's family? Only because Jesus brings you into God's family. How do you enter God's family? Only in Jesus, by being united to Jesus through the cross, by his grace. And then look again at all these labels. None of these labels matter. No one is in God's family because they deserve to be. That is, it's not that good people are in and bad people are out. It's not even that victims are in and perpetrators are out. It's not just the sinned against who are in and sinners who are out, because you can be poor and unknown and a victim, but you've no more right to be in God's family than if you are rich and famous and moral, and vice versa. Because whoever you are, whatever you've done, whatever your family, whatever your background, whatever your past or your future, you only come into God's family through Jesus, and you only come in because God is gracious. And you see, Jesus came from a family of screw-ups and flakes, and he came from them, and he came for them. And if you think my family background is messed up, then just look at Jesus' family. Or perhaps this morning you think, well, it's not my family that's messed up. I'm the one that's screwed up. I am any one of these. I'm a sexual sinner. I'm a liar. I'm a cheat. I'm a bully. I'm someone who can't be trusted. I'm someone who has known God's grace for decades, and yet I still sin. I am someone who's heard God's promises, and yet I still mess up. But you see, Jesus came from people like you, and he came for people like you, and he brings you into his family by his grace. And there may be things that you can't forget. There may be things that you regret. You wish you could turn the clock back. And you maybe wonder this morning, will Jesus still have me? Well, please know he didn't just come for people like you. He came for you. And that's what Christmas is all about, that Jesus came and he came for you. And Matthew 1 shows us that he came from people like that. He came for people like that, because you are only in his family because of him and because of who he is. As I say, you look at all these labels. Are there any that don't apply or that you can't fit into? Do you think there's any label that you can put on that Jesus wouldn't accept you? If you can find something, I'd love to hear that conclusion. Because Jesus' family tree shows actually both the worst and the best that humanity has to offer. But Jesus came for everyone, and you only come in through him. And if you still feel, well, I'm not sure I'm meant to be here. I feel too small to feature on this list. I feel too insignificant. Remember, God seems to love the small and the overlooked and the insignificant. Actually, thousands of years ago, it was older sons that mattered. It was firstborn sons that mattered. They're the ones who inherited the farm. They're the ones who were important. Firstborn sons were the ones that you wanted. But God chooses younger sons. So verse 2, God chooses Isaac, not Ishmael. Verse 2, God chooses Jacob, not Esau. Verse 3, he chooses Perez, not Zerah. Verse 6, he chooses baby-faced David, not his seven big, manly older brothers. That is, God chooses younger brothers. But he also chooses older women. In Old Testament times, New Testament times, perhaps even today, men choose women who are young and attractive. But God chooses old Sarah, who can't have children, not young Hagar. God chooses older Leah, whose husband Jacob doesn't like her, doesn't love her. God chooses Leah, not beloved Rachel, to become the mother of Judah, the tribe of Judah. God chooses old Elizabeth, who can't have children, to be the mother of John the Baptist. And as you feel too small for God to notice you, God chooses the boy everyone overlooks, and God chooses the girl no one wants. You feel too small for God to notice you? The Son of God himself was almost too small to be noticed and became a baby. You had to support and cradle his head. He became small. You think you're too small for him to notice you? These are the kind of people Jesus came from, and this is who Jesus came for. And you come into his family by his grace, not by your CV. You come into his family not because of who you are, but because of who he is. Not because of anything you've done, but because of what he's done. And in fact, the only thing that will keep you from God's family is if you think that you're big and important and strong and that you don't need him. All through the Gospels, the only people that Jesus turns away are those who think that they're big and strong and important and they don't need him. But this is Jesus' family tree. This is who he came from. This is who he came for. And that includes you. And one final thought as I finish. I've picked through Matthew 1, and as I've picked up these characters, I've done something the Bible never does. I've shown you how messed up all these characters are in the Old Testament, but the New Testament never does that. In other words, I've done something this morning that the New Testament never does. Because when the New Testament looks at the Old Testament saints with all their flaws, it only ever praises them. The New Testament always shines a light on what God has done by his grace, and they praise God for that. So, for example, you take Hebrews 11, that great kind of list of the heroes of the faith, and you've got guys like Abraham, but they don't mention that, his lack of faith. You've got heroes like Moses, but doesn't talk about his temper. You've got Gideon, but doesn't mention that he's a wimp and that he creates an idol that leads his family astray. It even praises Samson, who's a womanizer and hothead and arrogant, and he's definitely not the guy you want your daughter to bring home. But the New Testament commends them. Or think of Jonah, who hates the people he preaches to, yet when Jesus mentions Jonah, he doesn't say anything about that. Or you think of Lot, who was seduced by Sodom and moved into Sodom and sucked into the life in Sodom, and he doesn't want to leave, and he's deeply flawed as a character, but when Peter talks about Lot, he calls him a righteous man 3 times in 2 verses. Gives him as an example of living in godless times. In other words, the New Testament never criticizes the Old Testament saints. They're always commended. Why? Because the Bible is not about them. They're in the Bible, but the focus is not on them in the Bible. The focus is not on them. The camera lens is not pointed on them. The camera lens is always focused on God and what he did in them, through them, by his grace. That's what matters. So too for you and me. What matters most about you is what God does in you by his grace. And you see, on that final day, when you stand before Jesus, he will not say, "Here's how much you failed your crucified Savior, now cry." He will say, "Well done, good and faithful servant. Well done, Rahab. Well done, Jacob. Look at how God, by his grace, worked in your life." And what will you and I boast about on that day? You will not boast in you and in the stuff that you did. What will you boast in? That only by his grace, only in everything that God has done in you by Christ, by his grace. So yeah, you and I are messed up. But God came from people like that. He comes for people like that. That is why Jesus came. And by his grace, we are his. And he is ours forever. Let's pray. The writer to the Hebrews says that Jesus is not ashamed to call us brothers. Father, what an amazing truth that Jesus is not ashamed of us. That you sent your son, your only son, the son whom you love, into the mess of real families and into real messy relationships, but you sent him to die for people like us, for people like those we've been reading about. And that he is not ashamed of us this morning. Oh, Father, what can we do this morning but fall on our knees and pray that you would melt our hearts, please, to see more of Jesus, so that our lives are so drawn to him that we can't take our eyes off him. We pray for your name's sake. Amen.